Today, I'm thrilled to welcome a true thought leader in healthcare transformation, Marty Ross, consulting principal at PYA and director of the Center for Rural Health Advancement. Marty brings over 30 years of experience in healthcare law, strategy, and policy. From her early days as a regulatory attorney to her current role guiding providers through the complexities of alternative payment models, Marty has been at the forefront of value-based care and system redesign. In this conversation, we will be exploring the evolution of alternative payment models, what's worked, what hasn't, and what's next. Marty shares insights into how APMs are being tailored for rural and safety net providers, what to expect from CMS's new team model, and how physicians can position themselves to lead in this rapidly changing landscape. Whether you're a healthcare executive, practicing clinician, or simply trying to make sense of payment reform, this episode offers practical wisdom and strategic foresight. Let's dive in. Welcome to PEMBA On Demand, Physician Leaders Making a Difference. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. PEMBA On Demand is produced for physicians seeking professional development. We discuss a wide range of topics on the podcast, including successful innovations in a variety of healthcare disciplines, current issues in healthcare career development, and healthcare leadership. I will be interviewing physician leaders from the U.S. and from other countries, most of whom graduated from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. The information provided in this podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute professional advice. The views and opinions expressed by the host and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the University of Tennessee or any other organization. By listening to this podcast, you acknowledge and agree to these terms. Whether you're sipping your morning coffee, commuting to the hospital, or just looking for a dose of inspiration, we've got you covered. We hope you will take full advantage of these practical, insightful, and relevant discussions designed to help physician leaders get new and build upon existing leadership skills and perspectives. PEMBA On Demand will allow you to be an even bigger force for good in healthcare. Well, Marty, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
As I've been preparing for this discussion, I've been looking forward to this for a long time now. I was impressed with your diverse and impactful career, starting out in law and then moving into healthcare consulting. And I'm just wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about your journey and how it led you into the world of alternative payment models.
Well, I did 20 plus years doing transactional regulatory healthcare work as full-fledged attorney in a law firm. And go back to 2010, 2011, during the debate on the Affordable Care Act. And most folks were focused on the insurance side of that legislation, right, to expand healthcare insurance coverage. But there's the back half of that legislation, which is really about, well, at least it has the intent of sort of reinventing healthcare, moving away from fee-for-service models to alternative payment models. And that was incredibly appealing to figure out, you know, how do I take my dark skills I've learned as an attorney and apply that in a positive way? Because really, the one foundation for alternative payment models is you have to have providers of all types and stripes working together, because it's about rewarding an effectively functioning continuum of care. You know, I'd spent decades with radiologists arguing with hospitals and back and forth and back and forth and always having to be the zealous advocate. And it got old, I have to tell you. So we thought now is an opportunity in this market to move to the consulting side of the house to try and build these relationships that will support alternative payment models. Kind of hard to believe in over a decade now. Certainly been a slow progression, slow transition in the industry, but there's definitely room for that type of work we've been doing.
We have been hearing about alternative payment models for a long time, and it does seem like it has been somewhat slow in coming. I noticed also that you have been working specifically maybe with a focus with rural providers, and how is that different, or is it different, I should say, is it different in the rural environments versus urban or suburban environments for healthcare organizations?
Well, maybe go back a bit. Some preface to answer that question is, with any alternative payment model, there are two components. There is the money, right? Figuring out how to make the money work to create the the correct incentives and to reward collaboration and cooperation across healthcare providers. But there's also just the work you have to do, right? The clinical transformation that's involved when you make that transition and how you pay, right? We're set up today around a fee-for-service model, right? So it's you get paid for the specific service that you provide, and there is no reward for doing that in a coordinated fashion, nor any significant reward for reaching beyond the four walls of the clinic or the hospital to really support an individual patient in their health journey. My experience is there are a lot of challenges figuring out alternative payment models and how to make them work in rural settings, because we're starting at a fundamentally different point with rural providers, because most of the primary players in that space, critical access hospitals, smaller rural PPS hospitals, rural health clinics, they're all working off some version of cost-based reimbursement. That's the federal healthcare program saying, we get it. Low volume, high fixed costs. The traditional model, PPS reimbursement, isn't going to work. So they've created these alternatives within the fee-for-service reimbursement for rural providers, right? So whatever you do in sort of, say, the non-rural setting to create a payment model, it's just going to look different how you finally figure out how to make that work in the rural setting, because it's just a different baseline. That said, I think the rural providers are embracing the clinical transformation component, alternative payment models, very well, right? They want to do the work of identifying evidence-based practices and implementing those protocols within their practices, within their hospitals. They're eager for that level of engagement. They have, by their very nature, had to work through a continuum of care, right? They don't provide all the services. They're not one-stop shops. And so they have had to have that collaboration with urban facilities. So they have a baseline to start with. So it's just, they have advantages. I guess the short answer is advantages in one area, disadvantages in the other.
Okay. One of the things that I think is interesting, in spite of the number of years we've been talking about value-based care and alternative payment models, is that a lot of physicians still have some confusion around what alternative payment models are. Have you found a way that explains this to physicians in a way that it really resonates with them?
Still working on that one, Norm, but here's my current thinking is, and trust me, it's evolved over time. I think you have to start alternative payment model formation side of the house, that it's moving from, I am a cog in a machine, right? I am a primary care provider. I am a specialist, to I'm a piece of a puzzle. And you have to figure out how the puzzle fits together, right? So how do specialists collaborate with primary care providers? How are they, so primary care is how are they providing a level of support that goes, again, beyond just what happens in the clinic, just what happens in the hospital? And so what an alternative payment model is figuring out an incentive structure that supports that type of care delivery. I believe most docs, at the end of the day, that's how they want to practice, right? They want to see a better health outcome. They want to see the outcome. And in many instances, they don't even see that today in how the system works. They, again, do their piece and move on. But it's because fee-for-service is set up to reward, do your piece and move on as quickly as possible even. And so the alternative payment model is figuring out, how do we adjust the incentive structure so that the way you want to practice is the way you get a practice.
And do you think that the APMs have evolved at this point where the opportunity for physicians to engage and really be rewarded for better outcomes is improving with the newer models?
Depends. It depends. It's just a very different world for primary care versus specialists. More work has been done on the primary care side under the captain of the ship theory, right? If we can get primary care right, get folks engaged in preventative care and healthy lifestyles and management of conditions, chronic conditions over time, that's our best starting, you know, it's our best starting point for alternative payment models. So yes, there have been a lot of initiatives around primary care and how do we change it from a straight fee-for-service model to some sort of capitation. I know capitation is a dirty word from the 1970s and 80s, but yeah. Really, how do we pay for assuming management of primary care for a patient. There have been models that have been successfully tested around that. And in some practices, they have successfully transitioned from kind of the traditional Medicare model to partnerships with Medicare Advantage plans and other commercial payers, where they've been able to assume some degree of risk for appropriate management of those patients. So I think that's, we've made progress there. Specialists is a different story because the primary mover in that space is episodic payment models, such as the team model that CMS is launching the beginning of next year, which is episodic payments around specific list of surgical procedures. And so the hospital in those models ends up being financially responsible for a total cost of care from the date of surgery till 30 days post-discharge. Yeah, the hospital is bearing the risk, but what that requires is a degree of collaboration with the specialists, the surgeons in that case, who are performing those procedures, and particularly the management of post-discharge conditions for those beneficiaries, for those patients. So that's been sort of the primary starting point on the specialist side. It's just more challenging to figure out because it's still a matter of how do we think of specialists as part of the team as opposed to just a handoff, right? Which is typically what happens today, right? Patient reaches a certain point, the primary care doc's going to hand them off to a specialist and then most likely hand them back to the extent to once the patient is stabilized to some degree.
Thank you for that answer, Marty. It seems that at best, our value-based care payment models, alternative payment models have really achieved at best moderate, maybe mild to moderate improvement in outcomes. How do you rate the likelihood that some of the newer models, and you mentioned team, and there, I know there are other ones coming out, what kind of a chance do you give them of really creating the type of change that CMS would like to see in this space?
So it's all of these models are comparing performance against an assumed benchmark. But what they're trying to demonstrate is, but for this intervention, the cost and the outcomes would have been X, right? So if we had just continued to provide the care the way we provide the care today, then actuarially, shall we say, we would have a particular outcome. So it's all about the benchmark and the accuracy of that benchmark. And what CMS has done and what some other payers have done is take historical costs and make a series of adjustments to predict what would happen in the future. And so the accuracy of the, I guess, the results of the payment model are dependent on the accuracy of that benchmark. So if you don't have an accurate benchmark, then you're not going to show, did in fact the alternative payment model generate savings or did it improve outcomes versus what our assumed baseline was. If you look where we started back in 2015 with initial benchmarks in the Medicare Shared Savings Program and where we are today with a number of the models that CMS is now testing, it's night and day. The sensitivity of those models, the manner in which data is collected, the time frame in which data is collected, the exclusions from calculation of the benchmark have all improved. And so it's really, I don't think, a fair question to say, how do we look at benchmarks comparison? Well, we're doing better than we were doing in 2015. Well, what we're really doing better than what we did in 2015 is have a more accurate starting point for sake of comparison.
So it's really a lot about data and analytics as well, mm-hmm. your ability to measure the improvement. And I agree, we have come a long way in that capability in terms of actually getting the data. I remember how big of a struggle it was when we started, just how are we going to get the data? I'd kind of like to move on now and talk a little bit about, maybe from a real practical standpoint, what are some of the most common missteps providers and healthcare organizations make when they're entering in to APMs or these ACO models?
Wow. It's interesting because, again, the models evolved. If you go back to 2015, it was primarily either existing provider associations, like a medical society, or it was a health system that would take their providers and say, we're going to do an alternative payment model. And it's going to be homegrown, because there weren't really external resources at that point in time. Fast forward to today, it's much more about I think the term population health management companies, these third parties that bring to the table data analytics, as well as care management, care coordination, transitional care management services. They bring that infrastructure to the table. So that's just, it's a very significant change. What I think may be lost in there is you cannot outsource this process, right? I mean, yes, you can have third parties that can bring you tools, but you still have to be able to use the tools effectively. And so I think there's been more willingness to get into alternative payment models because now folks feel supported with these types of management companies. But at the same time, the risk there is thinking, well, I've hired a management company to do this. I can practice in the exact same way I always practiced. I don't need to change my workflow. That's not going to be a recipe for success.
Gotcha. So that would be one of the more common mindset errors that organizations develop or physician organizations develop is just outsource it and forget about it.
Exactly.
Okay.
And there's too many moving pieces to this. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, those management companies can do if they are your partner, they can be extremely helpful. They can handle the data analytics side. They can help you understand your patient population and how that population needs to be managed and the different resources that need to be brought to bear to improve overall outcomes in that population. But if you're not engaging with that process and say, okay, these are the patients I need to focus on, or I can identify a need for a workflow change to make sure that when we identify this patient as someone who would benefit from enhanced transportation services or potentially a food as medicine program, for example, you got to change the process in the practice to make that happen. And that's where we're seeing that drop off.
Yeah. So I remember an analogy when I first was involved in leading these transitions into alternative payment models, where we would talk about timing the transition from having a foot in one canoe and a foot in another canoe to when we're going to have both feet in the APM canoe instead of fee for service in APM. Where are we at in that transition right now? Are there organizations that should have both feet in the APM canoe, or are we still trying to decide when to make that leap?
I think there are very few organizations that have truly made that transition, in part because you have multiple payers in the market. And so you may have successfully made the transition in Medicare Advantage, and maybe even you're participating in a traditional Medicare model as well. But you still have commercial patients or Medicaid patients where it's the same old fee-for-service world. And so how you treat, we see the issue here is how we've created processes to support our patients that are in alternative payment models are not necessarily rewarding us for all those other patients. So unless you have the very few instances where folks have aligned all those payers, you're still in both canoes. And that's, I think, a reason a lot of folks are not willing to put their foot in the APM canoe at this point, because they appreciate how unsteady it is. That's interesting. One of the most recent models, one of the last models that the Biden administration announced through the CMS Innovation Center was the AHEAD model. Don't ask me what it stands for, but it's an initiative at the state level. And there are, I think, 5 states that were selected to participate in the model. But it is alignment around all payers. So it's those instances where the state has been able to engage with their own Medicaid program. They have alignment through the traditional Medicare program with CMS. They have partnership with the MA plans in their state, but also then the major commercial payers. It's one of those few instances where the fact that there's usually one dominant player in the market is beneficial. It's when you're trying to negotiate some arrangement of an APM around that. And so I think that's, you're seeing more push toward that, towards that kind of alignment. But I mean, appreciate there's really nothing in the system that's pushing commercial payers towards alternative payment models, at least up to this point, because they understand fee-for-service. They understand how to run prior authorization and denials as a vehicle for controlling costs. They have been able to this point in time, if utilization goes up because there's more fee-for-service delivery, premiums go up and they continue to be paid just as they are. So the payers have not been forced to a position of risk yet. They are operating under effectively the same model. So that's one of those pieces we got to figure out how we're going to change to get alignment across multiple payers.
It's interesting that you bring that up. I know we're 5 years away from the 2030, which is when CMS wanted to have 100% of their beneficiaries in alternative payment models. And it sounds like what you're saying is one of the barriers is that the providers can't jump into the APM canoe while the commercial payers don't have any incentive to move in that direction. And there are new models out there like AHEAD, the REACH ACO, TEAM you mentioned briefly, but it doesn't sound like any of those are really a lever to move the commercial payers into this space.
At least to this point, they haven't. And mm-hmm. I referenced previously the fact that it may be a benefit to have concentration in a market. This is actually an example where concentration isn't good, right? It's because my home state of Kansas, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Kansas, probably controls 80% plus of the commercial market.
Yeah.
And they will pay lip service to alternative payment models, but they are not taking contracts to providers saying, here's an alternative payment model we want to test with you. That's not happening. In that case, then I know as a provider, well, for my Blue Cross Blue Shield patients, I'm living in a fee-for-service world. And I got to manage, I think, you know, what I've seen is a dramatic increase in prior authorization requests and denials. I'm having to devote resources to managing that fee-for-service component of my practice. I can see the benefits of a very distinct population, which is the Medicare population, right? Able to manage that more effectively under an alternative payment model. But, you know, at this point, I can't even get most commercial payers to reimburse for care management services on a fee-for-service basis. You know, that was one of the starting points for CMS, because at the same time they introduced the Medicare Shared Savings Program, sort of the, you know, original alternative payment model in Medicare, at the same time they were doing that, they were creating the first fee-for-service reimbursement for chronic care management services. And so that provided, you know, a vehicle for practices to build the capacity to deliver that type of service because they were receiving fee-for-service reimbursement for it. And on the assumption that if I build the infrastructure for care management services and I'm billing on a fee-for-service basis, it's still going to end up saving money because the care management services I'm providing will reduce total cost of care, right? And in an effective alternative payment model system, I want to increase the amount I'm spending on primary care. I want to increase it significantly because I know the payoff then is less hospital admissions, fewer readmissions, fewer emergency room visits that need to accelerate to specialty care for certain chronic conditions or acute conditions even. So I want to say, so CMS made that deal. I'll spend more on primary care to accomplish that. You're going to look at, and we try and figure out which commercial payers are now paying on those codes. It's the minority, not the majority.
This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podpodcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. So it seems like it's going to be a challenge to hit that goal of 20 that they set in 2030. There's a lot that has to happen in the next 5 years, and 5 years seems increasingly like a blink of an eye to me in terms of reform.
The other piece of that is if you do scour down the CMS website, the 5-year strategic plan is no longer on the website.
Okay.
And so I think the Trump administration is moving differently in their approach to alternative payment models. You know, the new head of the CMS Innovation Center comes from private equity, has a strong tech background. I think that's what we're going to see in terms of realignment of what the Innovation Center is doing is more, and they've said this very clearly, these are going to be risk-based models. We have an expectation that the provider is going to be taking risks. And I almost wish they'd stop. If I could change one thing about how we talk about alternative payment models, it's risk. I mean, it's just what risk says is you may not get paid the same as you would have been paid under a fee-for-service system, right?
Right.
I don't know why that's necessarily defined as risk. It's because what we've done is we figured out how to operate within the confines of a fee-for-service model, right? We know what our costs are, and we know what our revenue can be from fee-for-service. And so we've aligned the two. If you move to an alternative payment model, right, which where you're actually paying for something other than an office visit, right? You just have to rethink what risk is. It's like, no, it's really, you have to realign. It's that clinical transformation piece of the puzzle, right? Yep. You have to realign how you're delivering services. It's not saying, well, I'm assuming risk because I'm going to get paid. I have the potential of being paid less than I would be had I been under a fee-for-service model. No, what we're saying is you're going to have to rethink how you deliver care.
Yeah.
And realign how you deliver care, because we're going to pay you based on that type of care delivered.
So one of the things that I think is interesting is you've had quite a focus on rural or underserved communities while you've been with PYA. And you mentioned critical access hospitals before, which in some ways have gotten an exception in terms of their payment model because they're still on the cost basis. And it's been a lifeline for them. Are APMs going to be a better lifeline for rural health systems, or are they going to put our most fragile and vulnerable health ecosystems under a non-survivable challenge?
So I see you have the easy questions out now. That's good. It's a question of access, right? That the entire purpose of the critical access hospital program, the rural health clinic program, is to have access to primary care and emergency services in the local community and figuring out how do we get that done? Because right now what we've said is low volume, high costs, based reimbursement on costs. And that will ensure that the fact you have to provide fewer services to a smaller population will not, by definition, prevent you from taking care of that population. There's a lot of thinking around where's the cost in the system, right? Is the cost in the system the critical access hospital, or is it a patient who doesn't receive primary care services locally? So their first entry point into the healthcare system is in a very expensive ER, or it's the delay in care, which results in a very expensive hospital admission. So we need, again, alternative payment models force you to think about the cost of a continuum of care and focusing on how one type of provider will be reimbursed under that model is sort of the antithesis of what we're trying to accomplish. Because it actually makes sense to continue the investment in these types of access services in rural communities, because we know if we don't manage them appropriately here, they're going to be far more expensive out here. And it's true, if you look at well-managed rural population that is receiving services closer to home, their total cost of care is not that different than folks that are receiving care in an urban system that's under, we're operating under a prospective payment system. There are certainly opportunities for improvement because there are a lot of, because there's many opportunities to drop stitches in the rural health continuum of care. But if you actually have a system that's working together well, they can control costs more effectively than saying, well, we're not going to have critical access hospitals because they're too expensive. Cost-based reimbursement doesn't work, because we're just going to spend money somewhere else. It's not like those people and their needs aren't going to go away.
Okay. So ideally, when these are being implemented by CMS, you're anticipating that they will take into consideration how valuable these rural resources are from an access standpoint. And they'll recognize that maybe it's a slightly different formula in terms of how do we reduce cost in rural health systems versus urban health systems, but you seem to be fairly confident that they are going to work to try to figure that out rather than result in a whole nother wave of rural providers or health systems just not being in the marketplace.
Yeah, you got to keep the eye on the prize, right, which is access. I want to manage that patient. And I can't do that from a physical location. I have to be integrated into the community. And if I don't have an access point in a rural community, then it's not possible to effectively manage those patients' care. And so you've got to account for that by having the right resources, like the canoe example. The other saying that we go back to the early days of alternative payment models is right heads, right beds. And it's just, it's so true, because I would much have, I mean, I want a patient in a rural community that has pneumonia. I want that patient in a critical access hospital bed. If not at home, right? If I can't manage it at home, they have to be in the hospital to manage certain conditions. I want them in a critical access hospital. I do not want them to travel 60 miles and be admitted to an academic medical center where they are losing money on that patient, because the cost structure is even more problematic than it would be in a critical access hospital.
Yeah. So many of the people in our audience are physician executives, physician alumni from the PEMBA program. What advice would you give to a physician executive to help them be the best advocate they possibly could be for their system or their provider group to engage in payment reform?
Again, I think it's a different answer based on whether it's primary care or specialty. Or even primary care as part of a multi-specialty system, you're going to approach that group of providers differently. They are the team that does provide preventative primary care. And they need to say, we have a patient population we serve. We have an identified patient panel. And we are going to understand that population. We'll have the data analytics available to at least provide us an historical perspective on the care they've received, the conditions from which they've been diagnosed. But also, we're going to do screening on social determinants to understand what the obstacles for this individual improving their care is. We're going to help those folks that have been diagnosed with chronic conditions and other, you know, life-changing conditions by providing care management services to support them. We are really going to be partners in care with those patients. And I think that's the attitude for primary care to really transform itself. And again, the great news is this is how the docs want to practice. They've accommodated to a fee-for-service system, and they understand, if anything, you know, doctors are brilliant at figuring out how to make the system work. And right now the system says, well, the fee-for-service model to deliver, to maximize the number of services you deliver for which there is top-line reimbursement. So that's, we have to rethink how we approach primary care. Then on the specialty care, the key here is really understanding how to work with primary care, right? To be a partner with primary care and get those patients so that the patient comes to them in far better shape. Because so many times the specialist is dealing with a patient that just, they're trying to address health issues that should be managed appropriately by primary care. They're trying to get the patient to a point they really can address the specific condition for which they've been referred. But then also having that hand back happen more efficiently as well, right? I mean, we're going to have a dwindling, I mean, everyone agrees, we will have a dwindling number of specialists in the workforce. So we got to get those folks to work a lot smarter and be a lot more efficient and see more patients. And I think we do that by eliminating this extra work that specialists have found themselves managing as a result of just, you know, the easy answer for primary care right now is hand off to a specialist, right? That's the easy button to hit. I want to reward the primary care physician for hitting the button when it's needed, not when it's easy. And meaning then I've got a patient that's being referred up to primary care that isn't going to be have a series of issues that already should have been addressed elsewhere. So I think that's sort of we want to get everyone doing what they trained to do, and as opposed to, you know, unnecessary cross-training that we see in the system today.
Thank you for that answer. Every answer you've given has given me more questions that I'd like to ask, but I know that we've got a limited amount of time, but I feel like maybe we should record another 3 or 4 podcasts, because I just keep coming up with more ideas in my head. But let's talk a little bit about the future. You mentioned new APM models that are coming out, and we talked about that at least at one point, Medicare had a 2030 goal of having 100% of their beneficiaries. But with where we are right now, what do you think we need to prepare for over the next 3 to 5 years in terms of APM adoption? What do we have to be ready for?
Norm, I am notorious in my family for calling the play wrong every single time, right? So, you know, yesterday was the U.S. Open, and that last putt, I was the person saying, no way it's going to go in. You know, 64-yard putt, guy wins the U.S. Open. So I'm notorious for not having the best crystal ball in the moment. But that's it. I spend more time thinking about healthcare than golf. That's the good part of it.
Well, just remind me not to look at your brackets for the NCAA division, you know,
never.
Championship. Yeah. Okay.
Never come close. I think I'm going to go out on a limb. I think we're going to see an explosion in mandatory alternative payment models, specifically episodic payment models. If team has a good year, if the first year of team is successful in reducing costs around these selected episodes, then instead of having 700 selected hospitals participating in that model, it's going to be all PPS hospitals with a limited set of exclusions. And I think it's going to go, now granted, the procedures that have been selected for team are high dollar, high volume procedures. So, but there are still opportunities for going beyond that. And then I think you're all, and you know, team is a surgical focused episodic payment model. I mean, CMS forever and a day had been working on a radiation oncology model that had been stopped and started for a variety of reasons. There were definite errors in the baseline calculations for that model. But I think you can see a resurgence in some of these, in that type of model, right? So specific to radiation oncology, we had the kidney care model that was focused in with endocrinologists and their management of patients requiring ESRD services. I think that's just going to explode, right? Because it's a lot easier to administer those programs. And especially if you have mandatory risk of them, right? I mean, first year of team is upside only, right? You don't have to pay any money back to CMS, experience an increase in total cost of care beyond their benchmark. Year two is mandatory, and it starts with a 3% discount to CMS, right? So CMS is guaranteeing a recovery to itself in those episodic models. So I think that's my prediction, is in next three years, expect a front-loading mandatory episodic payment models. Beyond that, I'm sort of at a loss what's going to happen. The shared savings model, the total cost of care reduction models like MSSP, like ACO REACH. The jury's really out still on ACO REACH. I mean, its predecessor, direct contracting model, DCM. The preliminary results on it were sort of mixed, but ACO REACH was intended to correct a lot of those inadequacies that were identified in the direct contracting model. So I keep wanting to say direct primary care, it's a completely different animal. But they've made corrections in the ACO REACH program. So it'll be interesting. We need to see where that's going to go. Because at this point, ACO REACH sunsets end of 26. And there's been no indication from the administration to this point whether they intend to extend it or introduce a new model that's based on lessons learned now from both direct contracting and ACO REACH. To me, that's a much more difficult, my crystal ball already hazy. Is much more hazy when it comes to those types of models. And again, I'm only talking about Medicare. The commercial payers just have not had the reason yet to move differently, to move in a different direction and pay for services differently. So we've still got that canoe problem that we're trying to manage.
So Marty, if I understand team correctly and the episodic payment model, you've mentioned several times that tends to speak more towards cost savings for specialty practices versus primary care. And if I understand the ACO REACH and the MSSP, those are kind of models that spoke to the captain of the ship and primary care transformation in order to cut costs. So is it fair to say that your prediction is a move away from engaging primary care in cost savings and just focusing on specialty?
Well, I think let me refine that message a bit. I think we're going to be more aggressive because we have tools by which we can be more aggressive in managing episodic costs. And by definition, episodic costs tend to focus around specialty care, right? I don't think we're going to give up on primary care. I just don't think we've figured out how to make it mandatory yet. I mean, yes, some MA plans have made it mandatory by creating a capitation model, which involved certain MLR goals that the primary care can reach and the like. I think we've got, until we can figure out how to get commercial to the table, I think we're limited in how much further we can take our reforms within the primary care model to push it towards alternative payment models. There'll still be the opportunities in traditional Medicare, hopefully some additional models within Medicaid as states look towards their MCOs to introduce alternative payment models as part of that structure. But until you get the engagement by the commercials, I'm not sure how we advance the ball down the road.
And I know our healthcare payment system is very different than other countries. Are there models out there from an international perspective that have gotten commercial payers to the table?
Well, I can't really think of a system that's even analogous to the United States in terms of commercial payers, right?
Right.
I mean, Canada, yes. I mean, in Canada, there's the shadow system, as they call it, right? Mm-hmm. There's the services you receive that are paid for, coordinated by the National Health Service. That may not be the right term, Canada, apologize. But then folks that want quicker access to services will access commercial coverage. They'll have an additional layer of coverage on top of that. That's probably the closest analogy. But otherwise, yep. One thought I've had, if we're going to go out on the deep end, the problem in commercial insurance is catastrophic care, right? You just don't know when it's going to hit.
Right.
You don't know when a person's going to be diagnosed with cancer. You don't know when they're going to have a trauma. You just don't know, right? And so the actuaries are always trying to figure out, how do we manage that risk? And they've got oodles of data by which to do that. What if we took catastrophic off the table? Mm-hmm. And I remember this debate back in 2009, 2010, around the ACA, when you talk about nationalized health insurance. Sounds really, that's a big step, right? But what if the federal government said, we're really the only ones in the right position to manage catastrophic risk. Mm-hmm. We can manage it across the entirety of the population. We can create a model, a tax model similar to the Medicare model, how we fund Medicare, or at least Medicare Part A with the trust fund. What if we could create something like that that would take the catastrophic risk out and say, let's manage everything we can manage appropriately. Let's make sure we have appropriate preventative services. Let's take care of chronic conditions. Let's take care of lower urgent need, right? And make a system that works effectively around that. But as long as we've got this catastrophic loss on the table, I think we're really limiting ourselves. And I think that, could we make a trade-off with the insurance, with the commercial insurers saying, okay, we're going to take catastrophic off the table, but our expectations for you in terms of what you're going to do with the rest of what you do, the risk you do keep, is going to be significantly greater. I think that'd be at least an interesting policy conversation to have.
Yes.
And maybe having the conversation would make the payers rethink their level of engagement mm-hmm. with alternative payment models.
Well, Marty, this has been great. I've really enjoyed our conversation. I wonder, what are some resources that people could tap into if they had more questions about the work that PYA does or the work that you do specifically in the rural healthcare systems?
Well, as we always say, it's all on the website.
Okay.
In particular, one thing PYA has done now, started in the pandemic, so about 4 years, we do roughly a bi-monthly webinar series called Healthcare Regulatory Roundup. And the regulatory is nearly silent in that title. It really is a series where a couple times a month we take issues, I mean, obviously the deep regulatory component as well, but other sort of health policy related issues, and we dive into that. And they're all available on demand on our website. You can sign up to get notices of those websites absolutely free. And we do as little marketing as we can. This is our service to the industry type of work. But I think those could be helpful to folks outside of what we do. I mean, in terms of some kind of guidance on where things are with alternative payment models, I'm still a fan of the Healthcare Learning and Action Network, the LAN, as they call it, which was sort of an industry government initiative that started soon after the ACA was passed. Their resources are really good, just to kind of provide basic definitions, basic trends in the market as well.
Great. Well, thank you for those. And I'll include those in the show notes for those of you in the audience today who would like to access those. But Marty, again, thank you for spending so much time with me today. It's been great having you on the show. And I really appreciate all your candid conversation about APMs.
Thanks, Tamara. I appreciate it.
That wraps up another insightful episode of PEMBA On Demand. A huge thank you to Marty Ross for joining us today and sharing her deep expertise on alternative payment models. From her unique journey from regulatory attorney to healthcare strategist, Marty helped us unpack the slow but steady evolution of APMs from their origins in the ACA to today's complex blend of capitation, episodic models, and total cost of care frameworks. We explored the challenges and opportunities facing both primary care and specialists, especially within rural health systems, where Marty's work through PYA's Center for Rural Health Advancement continues to make major impact. She also reminded us that clinical transformation, not just financial restructuring, is at the heart of sustainable change, and that while third-party management companies offer support, they're not a substitute for meaningful internal change in organizations. Marty also gave us a candid look at the uneven pace of reform, particularly the lack of engagement from commercial payers and the delicate balancing act many providers face with one foot still in fee-for-service and the other in value-based care. And looking ahead, her bold prediction, a surge in mandatory episodic payment models if early results from TEAM are strong. For physician executives navigating these changes, Marty's message was clear. Stay focused on access, embrace clinical integration, and advocate for models that reflect how we want practice, not just how we've been paid to. If you'd like to learn more about Marty's work or PYA's Healthcare Regulatory Roundup webinar series, be sure to check the show notes. And if today's conversation sparked new ideas or questions, we'd love to hear from you.
PEMBA On Demand is released biweekly, every other Thursday, and available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Castos, or Overcast. Please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast player by clicking the subscribe button. Add PEMBA On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could share the podcast with your friends or colleagues. You can also listen to our podcasts on our YouTube channel, www.youtube.com/@PEMBAON-demand, all one word, no spaces. Please hit the like button and subscribe. Also, if you have any comments or questions regarding this or other episodes, please feel free to add them into the comment section on our YouTube channel. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to our website and our YouTube channel in the show notes. The website is tiny.utk.edu/PEMBA On Demand, all one word. There's no hyphen in that URL. You will find the links to the episodes there. Please also check the show notes for links that were discussed in the show today. Take good care of yourselves and become an even bigger force for good in healthcare.